So it's quite interesting to really look at these eight in more depth, especially the side that feels delight, and see if they actually make us happy. Yeah. When you get some money or material possession, initially we feel happy, but then we feel unhappy at the credit card bill. We feel unhappy when our friend got something nicer than we did for less money. Mm-hmm. Don't we? We feel unhappy when our new car gets dented. We feel unhappy when our money gets stolen. We feel unhappy when the stock market goes down. So the more attached we are, the more delighted and attached we are to getting the stuff, the more dejected we're going to feel when it disappears or when it breaks. There's a very direct correlation there. The more our mind clings, the more disappointed we're going to be. Okay? The remedy, don't cling so much. But then, when we hear, don't cling so much, we almost go into a heart cardiac arrest, you know, because we think, if I don't have those things, how am I going to be happy? You know, Buddhism is saying, don't enjoy life. Yeah, they're saying, don't have money, don't have pretty things, don't like to get presents. Buddhism is so depressing. You know? It's bad to feel happiness. So we mistake the whole thing. And we think that the Buddha's trying to make us miserable. Now, if we had any intelligence and thought about it, would an enlightened being deliberately try to make us miserable? Yeah? If you're an enlightened being, is that what you would do? I don't think so. Anyway, do we need an enlightened being to teach us how to be miserable? Yeah. We can be miserable all by ourselves, you know. There's the perfection of generosity, ethical conduct, you know, patience, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom, and we perfect the perfection of being miserable. Yeah. All by ourselves. Yeah. So you have the perfection of shopping, the perfection of misery, the perfection of complaining. Yeah. We do all these very, very well. But anyway, you know, look at it, how hooked in we are, and how we think this is going to make us happy, and it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't. We feel flat. And I've lived in many countries on this planet, and there is so much more mental suffering in this country than any other country I've lived in, and yet we're the wealthiest country. Yeah? If all of our stuff really brought us happiness, how come we are so miserable? So Buddhism is not trying to take away the happiness from us when it says don't get so involved in feeling delighted over these things. Buddhism is, you know, the Buddha is just trying to get us to be more balanced and realistic, because the less up we are, the less down we're going to be. And when we go down, we do a good job of it. We go very down, don't we? Very down. That's money and material possessions. That one is actually rather easy compared to the next one. The next one about praise and approval versus, you know, blame and disapproval. We are so hooked into that one, aren't we? Yeah. We really want people to approve of us. We really want people to like us. We want them to, you know, to say good things about us. And we work very, very hard to try and convince them that we're a good person so that they'll praise us. So we have in our mind We create an image of what we think they think we should be. You familiar with doing this? Yeah? There's somebody that you like, or somebody you respect, or somebody that you want to like you. So you think, what kind of person do they want to be with? And then you try and become what you think they think you should be. Okay? So we get the right clothes, we say the right things, we present ourselves in a certain way, we pretend to like things that we don't really like because the person that we want to like us likes those things and we want them to like us. So we don't say, you know, I think golf is so boring. You know, you don't dare say that if the person you want to like you likes golf. You say, oh, it is very interesting. Look at Tiger, what's his name? You know? Yeah, that's amazing how he hits that little ball. And we try and be so interested in it. I can divert to another story. I remember, this was reminding me, my freshman year in college, I was dating one guy. I went to USC my freshman year in college. So I was dating one guy that I really wanted to like me. Okay, so he wanted to go to a football game. So I think football's so boring. But I went to the football game, you know, so that I could be with this guy. So this was in the days when O.J. Simpson was playing for the USC. And we were sitting there rooting for O.J. And do you know what you screamed in the audience to root for O.J.? Kill, kill, kill. That's what the audience used to scream at USC. Isn't that amazing? Anyway, back to the topic. Yeah? So, you know, you try and make yourself into what you think somebody else thinks you should be so that they'll praise you and they'll like you and they'll say nice affectionate words. And we fish around for that a lot too, don't we? Oh, I feel so inadequate. Hint, hint, hint. You're supposed to tell me how talented I am. Yeah? Don't we do this? Yeah? Oh, I just feel like I don't look very good. Hint, hint, hint. Yeah? And then if we get the praise and approval, then we feel very good about ourselves. If we don't get them, then we get angry sometimes, or we might lose our self-confidence totally. And if we get the opposite, we get blamed. What happens when you go to work and you get blamed for something? From the time we were little kids, we hated getting blamed. Have you ever noticed that what people blame us for is never our fault? Yeah? It's never our fault, is it? From the time we're kids. You know what I think some of our first words are as American kids? It's unfair. Do you remember this? Yeah? I always used to call it, it's unfair. It was my brother. He started it. And yet then we just, you know, we start out as kids like that, you know. Oh, me, I didn't do anything. It was my friends, it was my brother, it was somebody else. It wasn't me, because I'm sweet little me, you know. And we continue that right through our adult lives, don't we? Whenever somebody calls us on something, oh, I didn't do that. Yeah. Or I did it because so-and-so told me to do it. We always have a reason why we made a mistake. In fact, it wasn't really a mistake. When we make it, it's not a mistake. When somebody else makes it, it's a mistake. But when we make it, it's not a mistake. And we get so bent out of shape when we don't hear praise and when we hear blame. Now, when you think, of the most painful things you've experienced in your life. Yeah, think about the most painful things you've experienced. Have they involved the words other people have said to you about yourself or about their feelings towards you? Yeah. So we're very sensitive to words. Yeah. Somebody thinks I'm good, I must be good. Somebody thinks I'm bad, I must be bad. Yeah. We completely go flat when somebody who we want to believe this in us doesn't believe in us. I think a lot of this happens because we're so used to relying on other people to tell us who we are that we don't bother to check in with ourselves. And we always look around at other people for what am I supposed to do that's good, instead of looking inside our own heart and seeing what our own motivation is and seeing if it's good. So if all our friends are doing it and we want our friends to like us, we do it, don't we? It's when you're a parent, that's what you tell your teenager not to do, isn't it? Don't do everything just because your friends are doing it. They sometimes do stupid, dangerous things. Don't do it. And then mom and dad are doing the exact same thing, letting their, you know, peer pressure by their friends. And then they wonder why their teenagers don't, you know, do the opposite. Well, we learn by example. But I think we're often very out of touch with ourselves. And so that's why we go up and down. You know, if somebody says, I love you, we're like in heaven. Somebody says, I hate you, we go kerplunk. Yeah, our parents approve of us, we feel like we're finally good people. Our parents disapprove of us, and we crash. We're always up and down. And I really think the remedy to this is getting to know ourselves and looking at our own motivation and learning to be very, very honest with ourselves about what we're thinking and what our intentions are. And this can be extremely challenging to be honest with ourselves, but it's the only way to do it, I think, to be able to develop reliable self-confidence. Because if we can be honest with ourselves, then if we had a good motivation when we did something, even if other people criticize us, we're not going to fall apart because we know that we acted from a good space inside of ourselves. Whereas, I don't know about you, but I'm very good at pretending to do something nice but having a rotten motivation. And so we get praised by that. How come so much of the praise that we get doesn't really feel full, what doesn't fill the hole that we have in our hearts? How come? I mean, we do all these things that people praise us. Do we still really feel good about ourselves? No. Why? Because I think, again, we haven't been in touch with ourselves and looked at our motivation. And because deep down, we often have a sense that our own motivation was manipulative or self-centered or whatever. So even we seem charming to these other people and they all praised us, we don't feel good about ourselves. And so we're kind of praise junkies. So then we do something else to become people pleasers, to try and get somebody else to praise us, because we keep on feeling that if other people will like us, then we must be a good person. But no matter what they say, we still can't overcome that lack of self-esteem inside. And I think it's, you know, precisely because we're not in touch with our own motivations and we're not honest with ourselves and we're looking at other people to tell us who we are. Okay. So it brings a lot of grief in our heart, doesn't it? This whole thing about praise and sweet words and being appreciated. And no matter how much we get, we always want more. We're kind of praise junkies, appreciation junkies. Couldn't you use a little bit more appreciation? Yeah. Anybody here feel like they have enough appreciation? People appreciate them enough? Well, none of us do.
Yeah.
We all feel unappreciated. But if we really look, a lot of people appreciate us. But we can't see it. And then, so, you see how we get so locked in and troubled by all this delight and disappointment, attachment and aversion? And then the same thing happens with reputation. Whatever group of people we're in, we want a good reputation within that group. So reputation doesn't necessarily mean that you're famous in society, but whatever our group is, we want to have a good reputation. So you come to the Dharma Center. Yeah. I want to be known for having the excellent meditation position. Yeah? So that everybody goes, oh, look at her. Wow, she sits so still. And I'm sitting here thinking, it's a company having a good reputation. No? Yeah. Or if you have a hobby or a sport, you want everybody to say, to have a good reputation as being, a good artist or a good musician or a good clown or a good bowler or a good football player or whatever. We want to have a good reputation. Whatever our workplace is, we want everybody in that workplace to think that we're somebody special. And so we work very, very hard. We can exhaust ourselves trying to, earn this good reputation. And you know what a reputation is? Think about it. What's a reputation? We all want a good reputation. What's a reputation? Reputation is other people's thoughts. Isn't it? That's all a reputation is other people's thoughts. Now, if their thoughts are anything like our thoughts, how long does our thought of somebody else's reputation last in our mind? Not very long, does it? Yeah? And yet we are so attached to these little bleep-like thoughts in other people's minds, because that's all reputation is their thoughts. And their thoughts come and go, like this and this and this and this. And we're so hooked on having a good reputation as if nobody has any other thing to think about besides us. And how dare they not think well of me? As if somebody's going to spend the whole day thinking, what a lousy person you are. Is that true? People are far too self-centered to spend that much time thinking about us. Yeah? And isn't that self-centered on our part to think they have nothing better to think about except what they think about us? And as if other people's thoughts make any difference whatsoever to anything. And yet we are so attached to our reputation. So attached, and it's so painful if somebody speaks bad about us behind our back. Isn't it? When you think, like in your workplace, or maybe your family, or even the Dharma Center, everybody's there talking bad things about me behind my back. We get really upset. This is just not okay. And yet, what is it? Other people's thoughts? Which they can't even remember the next day, and they change their mind the next day anyway. It's true, isn't it? They say nice things one day, bad things the next day, nice things Sunday, bad things the next day. So again, this delight and disappointment, it takes so much energy. And then, of course, all the sense objects, the fourth one, trying to get all the nice sense objects that we want. It's thoroughly exhausting. And have you ever noticed, I mean, we're so meticulous. This is a good exercise. When you're eating, okay, you have different food on your plate. What is your motivation for having carrots this bite, and tofu that bite, and salad the next bite? Why do you put on your fork everything that you put on your fork for that particular bite? Because we think that that is going to make us happy. Yeah? We have the carrots. Okay, I've had enough carrots. Maybe the tofu will make me happier. Yeah, this bite of tofu is going to do it. And we have the tofu. I'm bored with the tofu. Yeah, I better have the salad. And we put salad on our plates. Have you ever noticed? Watch how you eat sometime. You know, and how you can play with the food, push it up, and think about what to put on your fork with each bite. Here, how much we think that's going to make us happy. And how concerned we are with our appearance, how we look, you know, in front of the mirror every morning. And, you know, how do I look? Yeah. And this isn't only women. Yeah. We're so concerned about how we look. I don't look good. Do you ever look as good as you think you should look? Anybody here satisfied with the way they look? Yeah. Very few people are satisfied with the way they look. Because we look at the magazines and we think we're supposed to look like the people in the magazines. And the people in the magazines don't even look like that, those people in the magazines. Yeah? But we go crazy trying to look like the people in the magazines. And so we feel perpetually disgruntled with our body. Which is very good for selling us things. Yeah? Because then you have to go on a diet to gain weight or a diet to lose weight, or you have to go to the gym, you know, and where you bulge, you don't want to bulge, and where you don't bulge, you want to bulge, and so you have to eat more, do certain exercises, or go here, go there, or get a certain kind of outfit that looks in a certain way. You know, all of this attempt to look good. And we're never satisfied. Never, ever, ever. So we go buy something else. It's crazy, you know. And, like, what is this body? Yeah? I mean, is the purpose of this body to decorate it and make it feel good? Now, from a Buddhist viewpoint, the purpose of this body is it's the basis of our precious human life. We want to practice the spiritual path. We can do it best with the human body, with human intelligence. So it's important to take care of our health and keep our body well and clean. But not because we want a good reputation, because we want to look good and we want to, you know. Oh, you didn't know that I was 56. You thought I was 36. But this body is just the basis for our Dharma practice. So we take care of it for that reason. And we keep it healthy because we want to live long. Yeah, so we can practice the Dharma. But we're so confused about all these things. And so we get so neurotic about our body. So dissatisfied, you know? Always, we all want to look younger. Anybody here getting younger? We're all getting older, aren't we? But what do we idolize in this society? You. We idolize what nobody is becoming. True, isn't it? And we buy into it. And our self-esteem is based on how we look. oh, there's some gray hair here. You outgrew the pimples and you've got the gray hair instead. And so, so much dislike of our body. And it's all really a waste of time. You know? Why be so neurotic about that? Okay, so what I'm trying to get at here is that these eight worldly concerns make us 100% miserable, but we're very caught into them, thinking that they're going to make us happy. And we're terrified to give them up because we think we won't have any happiness unless we get them. You know, unless I have money and material things, unless people love me and tell me I'm wonderful, unless I have got a good reputation, unless I have all sorts of beautiful, you know, sensual experiences, I'm going to be nothing. You know? And we're dreadfully afraid of giving up all of that. And yet, in trying to get it, we're miserable. Okay? So what the Buddha said, you know, fresh air in this, you know, thing, is, yeah, the pleasures of this life last only a moment and then vanish. True, isn't it? Yeah. So rather than aim for the pleasures of this life, aim for the bliss of liberation. Aim for the bliss of enlightenment. Develop the bodhicitta so that you can really make a positive contribution to the welfare and happiness and joy of other living beings. Because seeking the eight worldly concerns is a total dead end in terms of having a meaningful life and even having a happy life. But if we change our mind, and instead we start to seek spiritual goals, we'll have much more tranquility in this life, and we'll have a much more meaningful life. And when we die, then our mind is peaceful and content. You mostly hear when people die. You know, when people, we hear people dying with regret. Okay. What do people mostly regret when they die? Yeah? If you were to die soon, what would your biggest regrets be? They often have to do with how we treated other people. Don't you think? Yeah? Do you ever hear somebody on their deathbed, you know, dying with regret because they didn't work more overtime? We don't hear that, do we? You know? People die with regret because they feel like they didn't express their love to other people, or because they were selfish and took things that weren't theirs, or because they didn't make their life meaningful. So I think, you know, we want to have a peaceful death and a peaceful life. If we change our priorities and make our priorities more spiritual ones, turn our minds more towards the Dharma, turn our minds more towards bodhicitta, turn our minds more towards love and compassion and altruism and social service, then during our life we'll be much happier. And when we die, we won't have any regrets. We'll be able to look back on our life and say, I did something good with this life. Yeah? Even if I just helped one or two sentient beings, yeah, I had a good intention while I lived. I did the best I could. You know? I tried to be kind to whoever was around me. And in that way, I contributed to the kindness in the world. And I feel good about that. Okay? So it's so strange how we cling on to the things that don't make us feel good. And yet, you know, acting with an altruistic intention, acting out of kindness, pulling ourselves out of this incredibly painful state of self-centeredness, now. These are the things that really bring joy in our hearts now and make our lives meaningful. Because when you think about the meaning of your life, is the meaning of your life really to have a lot of money and a family and have everybody idolize you and think you're wonderful? When none of that stuff sticks? And when you don't feel good about yourself anyway? Or can a meaningful life be really doing our best to overcome our mental afflictions and self-centeredness? Really doing our best to genuinely care for others? And contribute to the benefit of society, to the benefit of other living beings? Doesn't that bring much more fulfillment in our heart, much more of a sense of a life well lived and satisfaction? It does, doesn't it? So I think we need to turn our mind more towards the spiritual aims. The eight worldly concerns obstruct us from our spiritual aims. And so that's why we try and reduce them as much as possible. Because the more time we spend running with the eight worldly concerns, the less time we have for our spiritual concerns and our spiritual practice. And we can't do the two at the same time, at the same moment. You might do one in the morning and one in the evening. But at one time, you can't have both, because they're two very, very different states of mind, aren't they? The mind of the eight worldly concerns is completely focused on me, I, my, and mine, and my pleasure, okay? The mind of spiritual concerns is really focused on long-term benefit, not only for ourselves, but for other living beings. And that actually brings much more joy and satisfaction.